And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is Tuesday, December 20th, 2016, 1:14 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're tuned into the Now program, and again, the last day of fall. Tomorrow, first day of winter, and shortest daylight hours. Tomorrow, December 21st, the winter solstice. So get ready for that. Momentarily, we are going to be joined here, I hope. That's the way the schedule went down, by Eric Lamond, who is the grandson of Three Stooge. Is that how you say that? Three Stooge? Three Stooge cast member, I guess. Member of the group. Larry Fine. So we will have that just in a second. I'm going to double check and make sure everything is holding up properly here. But in the meantime, I did mention that this past Sunday on the Heaven Express program, I heard Paul and Glenna. Well, actually, wait a second. We're getting a call here, so this might be it. So we're going to come back to that thought momentarily. But we're going to take a break and come back with hopefully Eric Lamond right after this. It's Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, right here on WWGH Radio from 12:10 to 2 p.m. Listen to the program for guests like these. The voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid and actress Pat Carroll.
And I think villains are the most fascinating people as an actress to play. They have more edges to them. They have more color to them. Isn't that a shame that goodness isn't more fascinating, or our world would be better?
I guess.
But there is something fascinated about tacky people, mean people. They're colorful. Good people always seem to be a little bit, ugh, yucky. But bad people always have edges to them. That's why they're so wonderful to play for actors.
That?
Because you can pick all the things in life as a human being that annoy you or that you would like to do to be really rotten mean. Most people are too afraid to be rotten mean because we want people's approval so badly. Being rotten mean isn't going to get us that. But, oh, villains for actors are the best things in the world to play.
You know, Pat, that almost describes our current political situation in this country.
Yes. Doesn't it just? I never thought of that, but you're quite right.
Join me Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio. We'll take your calls, 740-383-9944, streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com.
Hey, Scott Spears back with you here on this Tuesday, December 20th, last day of fall, if you can believe that, with 20-degree temperatures here in Ohio, 2016, 17 minutes past the hour, and this is going to be a great pleasure to speak with a man whose grandfather, I would hasten to say, is not known by anybody in this country, and his grandfather has not been with us for close, I guess, over 40 years now. Gosh, hard to believe that. Eric Lamond, who is the grandson of legendary Three Stooge, Larry Fine. Eric, how are you?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you today?
Doing
nice with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice to be with you. I wasn't even sure how to say that. Three Stooge, is it castmate, would you say, or member of the group? How would you define your grandfather's role in that group?
Well, Larry and Mo were the two of the six men who portrayed the Three Stooges who were there from day one to the last day. So Larry was a part of that iconic comedy team throughout their entire performing career. And I don't know exactly how you would categorize Larry and Mo and the rest of the guys other than the fact that we like to refer to them as the greatest comedy team of all time.
I think many people would agree with you. Eric, just to kind of get a perspective here and for people, Larry died in 1975, I believe.
Correct.
When were you born?
1949.
So you saw a lot of Grandpa.
Well, I saw a lot of him. the house where I grew up was close to where Larry and my grandmother, his wife Mabel, lived. I got a chance to work with the guys a little bit. My father hosted their television show in Los Angeles for many years, so spent a lot of time around Larry, of course, and had an opportunity to spend time around, especially Mo and Curly Joe. I knew Shemp, and I knew Joe Besser. The only one I did not know was the original Curly.
1949, because if I have this right, and let me know if I don't, the big resurgence in the Three Stooges after their initial run came about 1959. Is that correct?
Yes. In late 58, Columbia released a few of their shorts to television, and the popularity exploded. And then by 59, they were virtually in every television market in the country. All through the 60s and into the 70s, they were a highly popular television show all across the country. They drew ratings, especially in some of the larger markets in the afternoon, that were just incredible. So that was a huge resurgence, and at the same time, in 1959, they started making feature films with Columbia. So they made a half dozen feature films between 59 and 65, did cameos and some others, and traveled and toured a lot and performed to live audiences all over the country. So it was quite a heady time for them.
So you were really born in 49, a very unique time, because during the first 10 years of your life, Grandpa had been a part of something great. The resurgence hadn't quite happened yet. What were those 10 years like? Were you aware before the resurgence who Larry Fine was, and what was he doing those 10 years?
Well, the guys worked continuously through December of 57 at Columbia making shorts. And basically the last day they shot the last short is the day that they were told, you're done, after 24 years. So for the next couple of months, the guys weren't sure what they were going to do. Larry's family had been in the jewelry business, and he thought about going into that. Mo was looking at a variety of options. And during those next few months, they received an awful lot of requests to come perform, and at the same time, Columbia came to them and said, hey, we've got a script, we want to make a feature film. So it was only about a year where they really weren't doing much of anything, but once they started getting the offers to perform live, away they went, and they made the feature film in 59, and it was just like they'd had a year off, if you will.
You know, not to belabor this point, but it's hard for people to imagine, because in their day, there are Laurel and Hardy, there is Martin and Lewis,
right,
there's all these great groups. But honestly, today, if you look at repeats on television and you look at just name recognition of people who were born after all of these guys have passed away, the Three Stooges is the most well-known. So it's ironic that they did not make a whole lot of money, did they?
Well, let me put that in perspective. They didn't make a whole lot of money compared to what they were worth. But at that time, anybody who worked in film was attached to a studio. Everybody was underpaid other than the absolute top stars. The money that they did make compared to the average working person was pretty good money. They were undervalued and underpaid by Columbia, and so was pretty much everybody else that worked there. So it's two sides of the same coin. Yeah, they were never paid by Columbia what they were worth. The other side of the coin is they made good money on a comparative basis to what you and I would do, let's say, at that period of time.
What I think about is this period from, and of course the Stooges started a lot earlier than this, but this period from late 40s to the late 50s, television is taking off. And like Martin Lewis, to this day, is thought of as high art, even though I would venture to say more people know the Three Stooges. Why were they not thought of in that vein, do you think, at that time?
The Three Stooges, especially during the 50s, they were, their humor was different. The slapstick element, the silliness, that was a period of time in society where women shouldn't like this. They also received a little bit of pushback on the violence, if you will, and it was cartoon violence, if you will, if you really look at it. So I think those were some factors. They weren't highbrow humorists. They did physical comedy. They did slapstick. And their slapstick and the action in their films were so good, people overlooked the dialogue. People ask or tell me, you know, I've seen all the shorts 20 times each, and I tell them, the next time you watch one, ignore the action, listen to the dialogue. So it was more a question of perception rather than reality. The thing that really puts it in perspective, though, if you take a step back, these guys performed from the 1920s to 1970 pretty much continuously. They banked over 300 hours of film. They performed in hundreds of venues to live crowds with thousands and tens of thousands of fans in attendance, and they're still popular. So, you know, whatever the perception was at that point in time, they have stood the test of time.
Being that we are on radio, I asked myself this question earlier, because you say they started in the 20s.
Right.
And a lot of those people who started in the 20s, when radio was really hitting its stride, 30s, 40s, and even into the 1950s,
right.
Jack Benny, Bob Hope, right. Martin and Lewis all went on and did radio shows. You just talked about the dialogue. Even though the Stooges were so physical, were they offered, or could they have done radio?
Well, they could have done a little bit. Remember, they were, when they came to Hollywood, they made the one film for Fox in 1930, Soup to Nuts. And in 33 and 34, they were still working off and on with Ted Healy, and they made several shorts and were in several movies for MGM. Then they struck a deal with Columbia. And basically, they were under contract to Columbia for the next 24 years. And they had several weeks of the year where they weren't shooting, but they were limited in what they could do, as was basically every contract player. They could do personal appearances. In fact, the studio lent them out to almost every other studio in town over that period of time for them to appear and even star in feature films for other major studios in town. But there really wasn't the opportunity, just from a time standpoint, of doing radio. Plus, their brand of comedy, as great as the dialogue was, the dialogue fit in with the action and the slapstick. So they were more visual, if you will, and I'm not sure it would have really worked for them to do a radio show. Difficult to translate what they did to sound only, if you will.
All of these guys who had done radio and started out in vaudeville and in movies, a lot of them, as I say, Bob Hope, Milton Berle, Jack Benny, when television comes along, network television really amps up in the early 1950s. Now, you would think this is, because at that point, television was grasping for anybody who would get ratings. Were the Three Stooges ever approached at that time, or were they still heavily under contract?
They were under contract into the end of 57. So they really didn't have much of a chance to do anything in the TV arena until they were let go. And like I said, when they're, and if you recall, in the 50s, the studios and the TV networks were not the best of friends. It was looked as a threat by a lot of the studios, this new medium, if you will. But finally, the content that the studios had started moving to television. And like I said, when the Three Stooges shorts first went to TV, the wild success and the audience draw was just overwhelming. And so they hit a second stride, if you will. And from 58 into the early 70s, their popularity on television was phenomenal.
When they stopped doing the work, when their contract ended in the late 1950s, did they think it was over? Did they have any illusions that they could go back and do movies, that they could do television, that they could do talk show appearances?
Well, they really weren't thinking in terms of television because it was still a relatively new medium. The three networks dominated it. They really had no way to go to another studio and get into the feature film business, they thought, because they'd been cranking out short films for 24 years. Yes, they did all through the 50s the occasional appearance in features. And so they really weren't sure, you know, what the next step was. They pretty much thought that they were done until the requests started to come in for them to make the personal appearances. So those two factors, going out on the road and making personal appearances, at the same time that the same audiences that would come see them in these cities could go home and watch them now on TV, it just ignited a huge swelling of popularity again. And it pretty much forced Columbia to bring them back in 59 to start cranking out feature films with them.
For people who did not get a chance to view it, when the Stooges went on tour in the 60s and 70s, when they would go out to a city, what was that like? Well, what did they do? Did they sign autographs? Did they do something on stage? What was it like?
All of the above. Most of what they did, it was a stage show. Where they would do a lot of shtick and a lot of their famous bits, like the Maharaja bit. They would do several of the skits, if you will, with the slapstick elements that they did in the shorts. They had their sound guys with them there because that was important. They mingled with the fans. They would do an hour show and then spend 3 hours signing autographs. I mean, their popularity was just enormous no matter where they went. They performed at the Calgary Stampede in Canada 1 year in front of 80,000 people in the snow came out to see them perform. We have a picture here, a panoramic picture of that in our office. It is just stunning to look at. They were incredibly well received during their personal appearances. The fans just loved it.
When they would go out, were they surprised by the turnout?
Yes, they were, because they hadn't done a lot of live performing since their vaudeville days, which was a whole different world than the type of performances they started to do in the late 50s and in through the 60s. Vaudeville was a different medium, if you will. You played in, you know, the old movie palaces and whatnot. These were different venues and just enormous crowds. Plus, they had the benefit of their shorts being on TV. They were surprised at the size of the crowds and the multi-generational aspect of the crowd. So you would see families there where mom and dad had watched the guys' shorts in the theaters, and now they had their children with them watching the guys live on stage.
Now, of course, today, and I imagine probably much of the same in the 1960s and 70s. When you say Three Stooges, it's Larry, Moe, and Curly.
Right.
Who was going out on these stage shows? Obviously, Moe and Larry were. Who, for the most part, was doing the third?
It was Larry, Moe, and Joe DiRita, who they referred to as Curly Joe. Curly had passed in 48. Shemp died in 55. Joe Besser worked with the guys, fulfilling the last couple of years of their contract at Columbia to crank out the rest of the shorts that they were obligated to do. And then when the touring opportunity came up, Besser could not travel. His wife was very ill. He was not able to travel. So that's when they brought Joe DiRita into the act as the third stooge. And it's the three of them that went out onto the road and performed, who did most of their TV appearances. With Shemp, they did some in the early 50s, Larry, Moe, and Shemp, but the bulk of their television guest appearances were Larry, Moe, and Joe DiRita. The feature films they made from 59 through 65 were all Larry, Moe, and Joe DiRita. And all of their touring was that threesome.
We really, even today, there are not a whole lot of interviews that we see of the Stooges, because Larry and Moe passed away in 75. Curly Joe was around till 93, but just not a whole lot of stuff in that direction. But I want you to tell me about the men as opposed to the actors, and we'll start with Moe Howard. What kind of guy was he?
Moe's persona, obviously on screen, was kind of the ringleader and the boss. Moe was off screen a typical family man, as were all the guys. They basically did two things. They all worked, and they worked hard at their craft, and the rest of their time was devoted to their family, to their wives and their children. And that's all of them the same way. They went to work, worked hard at what they did, and the rest of their time was devoted to their family. And what's really funny, around the house, they were all pretty handy, although in every short, when they picked up a tool, you knew that the mayhem was about to begin, and so their personas off camera were different from that respect, and they were all genuinely easygoing, nice guys. You know, they just worked hard.
Aside from what you've just described, was there any discernible difference in the personal life of Shemp, Joe Besser, Curly Joe?
One to the other, I think the biggest difference is the activities they liked off screen. Shemp was a huge fight fan, as was Larry. In fact, as a kid, I went to the fights with them a lot. My dad and I would go to the fights with Shemp when I was really little, and then Larry all the way through the 50s. They basically spent their time away from the camera in a family-oriented manner. So there was a lot of similarity in how they led their lives off camera. They worked a lot, and they practiced a lot. And so the time away from work was important to them, and it was all family oriented, so there was a lot of commonality in how they approached their lives off camera. They socialized together to lesser and greater degrees depending on the logistics of who was living where, but there wasn't a huge difference amongst any of them. The one that was somewhat different was the original Curly. Curly off screen was a lot like Curly what you saw on screen. So Curly didn't have much of a filter. He enjoyed life to the fullest, and he liked the ladies, and had a good time.
What was your grandmother, Mabel, like? What was it like to be the wife of Larry Fine?
Well, she appreciated the lifestyle that Larry's work gave them. Mabel had four sisters, so she spent a lot of time with them. And just basically maintained their household, socialized somewhat. They knew everybody in town, from restaurateurs to the rest of the Hollywood community, and just pretty much led a reasonably tame home life. And obviously they had the two children, my mother and my late uncle John Fine. So, you know, she had the role of mother and wife and maintained their household, and as I said, spent quite a bit of time socializing with her sisters, and kind of the typical 1950s housewife, if you will. She wasn't impressed with the Hollywood scene. She had been in vaudeville herself. Her and her one sister, Loretta, had performed in the 20s, all through the 20s, as the Haney sisters. That's where she met Larry. So she knew the backside of the business, if you will. She'd been in it. She appreciated the lifestyle it provided, and she wasn't, what's the word I'm looking for? It just didn't faze her that Larry was in the entertainment business. That was his job.
So many people say they're friendly, and when they're working together, it's not that they dislike each other, but when the project is over or there's some downtime, they really only see each other when they work together. Were the Stooges friends? Did they have barbecues together?
Yeah, our family, Larry's family, including my family, we socialized more with Moe's family than anybody else. My Norman Moore, Moe's son-in-law, who started out illustrating their comic books and then actually produced and directed several of their films in the 1960s, and my dad, who, you know, hosted their TV show. They were friends, and Joan, who was Moe's daughter, and my mother were friends. So we socialized fairly regularly with Moe's family. Shemp, widow, after he died, Babe Howard, socialized a lot with her. Joe DiRita usually held the big rap party at his home after they would finish filming any of their features. And the other thing that kept them together a lot is these guys didn't go to the set, do their day's work, and just go home. They spent a lot of time in between together at one of the guys' homes or the other, practicing and practicing and practicing their routines. I remember when I was a kid, we were visiting my grandfather and grandmother, my mom and I, and Mo came over, and Larry and Mo are in his living room practicing shtick that they've been doing since the 20s. And I asked them both, I said, do you guys do this a lot? And they both pretty much gave me the same answer. This is the only way we can maintain our edge and be really good. We have to practice this all the time. It's more intricate than it looks, and if we didn't, we'd beat the hell out of each other if we lost our timing. And he says, and you know, to be good at what you do, you have to continue to practice it. The analogy they used was an infielder, a professional baseball player that takes 1,000 ground balls, you know, in between games.
When you went over to Grandpa and Grandma's house, what was it like?
I don't think it was really much different than any of my friends going to visit their grandparents. There might have been a few more people there because usually some of one or two of Mabel's sisters were there visiting. It was typical stuff. Let's have dinner. Let's have a barbecue. You know, just normal family activity. There wasn't anything out of the ordinary from that standpoint. It was just going to visit, for me, when I was growing up, going to visit grandma and grandpa.
When did you first get the perception that grandpa was a big deal?
I think when the first time I went to a movie theater, which was the old Lemley Theater on Vermont Avenue in Los Angeles, and saw the first time his shorts on the big screen and saw the reaction of the audience in the theater. That's when it dawned on me that, ooh, that's my grandfather, and these people are laughing and applauding and cheering and having a great time. That's when it first dawned on me, when I actually watched their performance up on the big screen in the movie theater.
Of course, anybody who talks about the Three Stooges is going to say their great work is the shorts. But when they get the resurgence in the 1960s before the unfortunate events of the 1970s, they did the animated series. They were doing the tours. They did the television pilot, Kook's Tour.
Right.
Did they like this work? Were they proud of it? Did they think it was on par with what they had done?
I worked with them in 65 when they did the animated series. I worked with them and appeared in several of the live-action wraparounds and went with it. And that's when I saw the professionalism. I watched these guys day in and day out for several months work real hard doing those little vignettes, practice and rehearse and, you know, tweak the script and just work real hard at it, which gave me a real understanding of how committed that they were. And it also dawned on me, this is why they were so good. They worked at it real, real hard. And they thought their work was okay in those. They thought their work in the films that they made in the 60s was okay. These were not big budget pictures, you know. They were Three Stooges comedies, long form, if you will. But their performance in each of those was true to the Three Stooges, with the mayhem, with the silliness, with the slapstick, and always that theme that was in the shorts and was in their films. You had these three guys whose heart was in the right place, they're usually trying to right some wrong or get the correct outcome, and they just screwed up royally. You know, the pathway they took to get to the result is what made it hilarious. It was somewhat different than the rest of us would have taken. And that was part of their charm. And they only picked on the big guys, if you will. And they were always trying to do the right thing. They were just somewhat inept at it.
In the 1960s, in the 1960s, before the major health setbacks of the 1970s happened. Was age becoming an issue? Were they aware of it?
They were aware of it, but the thing that I was going to say amazed me, it didn't, because I'd watched these guys for a long time. They were all in pretty good shape. They could all, they were all very good dancers. And like I said, they were in good shape, and they tried to maintain that because what they did was physical comedy. Yeah, they did a few less of the bigger slapstick stunts and whatnot as time went on, really didn't affect their performance too much in the 60s. They'd been doing it for so long, they practiced it for so long, they had it down so pat, and like I said, they stayed in shape. So they were able to pretty much continue performing at the same level, pretty close, all the way to the end.
Your grandmother passed away in 1967. Larry was out on tour. What effect did that have on him?
He was devastated. My mother called him, and he flew back. My dad picked him up at the airport, brought him to our house, and for the next day or two, he basically just stood or sat in the living room of our home, lost, would be how I would categorize it. They had been together a long time. She was the center of his life off screen, and it was a devastating event for him.
He did go back to work, though, and actually, they were doing a television pilot, as I understand, Kook's Tour, 1970, a movie pilot.
Right.
And Larry had a stroke. Were there any signs that anything was wrong? And kind of take me through what happened there.
That was a bolt from the blue. There was no signs. Larry was healthy. Like I said, it just, boom. He had the big stroke and some little ones. And it ended the Three Stooges as a performing entity. They were filming Kook's Tour, which was actually designed to be a pilot for a TV series. And obviously, Larry was not ever going to be able to perform again. And the guys were all at an age where, after that event took place, they decided that was pretty much it. Other than, you know, doing guest appearances on talk shows and things like that, it ended the Three Stooges as a performing entity. So basically, they were filming from 1930 to 1970 pretty much all the way through.
The 5 years between the stroke and Larry's death in January of 1975, what were those years like for him?
Well, it was difficult for the family. Larry spent about 3 years at my mother's home after the stroke, going through rehab, and he was, you know, we had the private duty nurses, and it was just the day in and day out reality of someone who had suffered a debilitating stroke and going through the, you know, attempts for rehabilitation, and of course, you know, getting up there in years at the time, so there were other issues that came about, and that's what led him to, the doctors finally said to my mother, look, he needs to be someplace where the medical care is more than just year-round-the-clock nursing care, and hence the move to the motion picture home, which he thrived at for the next couple of years. It was a kind of a focal point of the family's life, you know, to deal with what Larry needed to go through his rehabilitation and live his life post-stroke.
There was this video that went around for a while. It was on YouTube of Larry being interviewed in the motion picture home, I think. Did the family know that was being done?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It was a different time. It was a smaller town. Access was somewhat easier, if you will. We were aware of most of the conversations and the interviews and whatnot. On occasion, there would be some things that would occur that we weren't aware of till after the fact. And part of the problem was Larry, all the guys, they were always accessible and always gregarious. Sure, come on over, let's do an interview. You know, they had no problem dealing with anybody. I mean, there's the famous stories. I mean, people showed up on Mo's doorstep from across the country. Hi, you know, I just came out here to California to knock on your door to say hi to you. And Mo would invite them in. They'd have a conversation. That's the way these guys were built.
When there were a few attempts to revive the Stooges in the 70s after Larry's stroke, Mo Howard's grandson had written a script, and Joe Derita had tried to do something on stage. Was Larry aware these were going on? Did they go to get his permission to do that?
He was aware of what was going on, there were some attempts. Is pretty much what told Mo and Joe, you know, hey, you know, we're done. I mean, to recapture what they had, they realized it's just not gonna happen. And they took a step back and also realized they had a pretty good run, you know. These guys performed for a long, long time.
Larry died in January of 75, and Mo died in May of 75.
Right.
5 months, 4 months, really, between each other. Do you believe there's anything to that? Was Mo heavily troubled by Larry's death?
Yes. It hit him hard. These guys had worked together, you know, for the better, for 50 years. They had watched each other grow their families. They were twined for decades in their personal life and in their professional life. There was a closeness there that is difficult to understand unless you've been in that position. And yeah, he took it very hard.
Tell me about, we have about 5 minutes left. Tell me about the final days of Larry. What was he in a good mood? He dealt with this stroke for 5 years.
Yeah.
But was he still having a good time? Did he know what he meant to other people?
That's an interesting question. And I think the honest answer would be probably not, because he never thought about it that way. He loved what he did. He enjoyed performing. He loved interacting with the fans. The money and the adulation and the lifestyle that brought him, he was thankful for, and he appreciated it. And all the guys kind of had that same attitude. Their focus was work hard at what you do and be really good at it. And so I never think they gave much thought to the depth and breadth of the fan base that was out there. They knew they had a lot of fans. They knew they were liked. Obviously, that made them feel good, that their work was appreciated, and they were very grateful to the fans, and that's, you know, part of why they would always mingle and sign autographs and talk to them. But I don't think they ever took themselves to any level higher than, hey, we're performers, and we work really hard at being as good at it as we can today.
We've lost a lot of great celebrities this year, and in this internet, cable, television world, we see how it's covered. When your grandfather passed away in 1975, What was that like? What was the coverage? Was there a great deal of outpouring? What was the services like? Was it a big deal?
Yes. a lot of people at the services. Lot of media. Letters poured in by the thousands. Telegrams. Phone calls. An event, if you will, when he passed. The services were, I was going to say difficult, that's not the right word. There are a lot of logistics to deal with that day. Family, my mother, of course, was devastated. And just, you know, a lot of media who wanted her time and lots of fans. And it was a difficult day.
I want to get, with 2 minutes left, three very short questions in here. When Larry passed away, you were 26 years old. Was he a guy who kept things other than video, or I guess it wouldn't be videotapes then, but just pictures or things like that? Did he keep outfits? Did he keep posters? Is there anything you have kept?
I'm going to tell you a story that'll make you cry. When they started to get the calls in 59 to go touring, in Larry's basement, he had a very big Mediterranean home in the Los Feliz Hills. Down in his basement were the trunks that they had traveled in vaudeville with. And I was down in the basement as a kid with Larry and Mo opening up those trunks, and in there were old scripts and music and costumes and props. And I watched them throw it all away because their conversation was, we got to get new stuff.
Oh.
And I wish I'd have known then what I know now.
They'd
taken all that stuff home and retired.
And
they all were the same way. They just dumped it. My mother had the spacesuits from Have Rocket Will Travel hanging in one of the closets in our house for years, and one day she says to me, get those damn things out of here, they're taking up too much space, I need the room. I mean, you know, it was a different time, and it was just stuff.
The final two questions I have for you: you were 26 when Larry died. You, I imagine, visited him quite a bit in the actor's home after he'd suffered these strokes, when he wasn't working, a little more time to talk with him. Not as a grandfather, but at that point, did you feel like you got to know who Larry Fine, the person, was?
Well, I always felt I knew who he was because I'd spent so much time around him, and I really got to know him when I was in college taking a speech class, and one of the assignments was, you need to go find someone famous, interview them, and give a speech. I thought, that's an easy one. So I spent several nights at Larry's home going in-depth questioning. I mean, hours and hours and hours, night after night after night for a week or two. And it filled in all the blanks. I got to really understand the man at a level I had not attained prior to that.
What's the most interesting thing you learned
about Larry?
Yeah, that you didn't know before that interview.
I would have to say I was not so much what I learned, but what I recognized to a much greater degree was the man's humility. He was grateful for his career. He was grateful for how the fans supported their work, and he was grateful for the life that his work afforded him. That's, I would say, the one thing that really stood out.
And the final question for you today, because I think we all know what the legacy of the Three Stooges are to people. I think it's different for everybody, but I think it's a commonality for people. But what is Larry Fine's legacy as part of that group and as a person?
Well, I think in the public arena, he'll always be remembered as a member of one of the most entertaining comedy groups that ever existed. Fortunately, we do have their films, so current generations and future generations can continue to enjoy them like we did. And I think that he just will be recognized, as will all of the guys, of, hey, these guys were good.
Absolutely. Eric Lemon, the grandson of legendary Three Stooge castmate Larry Fine. Eric, thank you for giving us so much time. This has been a real pleasure.
I appreciate it, Scott, and happy holidays to you and yours and your audience, and hope we get to talk again soon.
Absolutely. Stay well. Eric Lemond, it doesn't get any better than that. And for this day, I'm out of here. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.